Hey everyone, it's April 10th, 2019, and this is The Takeaway with me, Tanzina Vega. A House hearing on the rise of white nationalism turns into a debate over whether the problem even exists. We break down the hearing and how both parties are approaching white supremacy. Also on the show, a bill in Georgia targets journalists. We'll talk about it.
We have had in journalism a code of ethics since 1926. It's a terrific code of ethics, and I don't know a single journalist in Georgia or beyond who doesn't try to follow the tenets of that code of ethics.
And New York Islanders broadcast host Shannon Hogan talks about the barriers women face in pro hockey commentary.
When I walk into a room, I kind of have to prove that I do know hockey a little more than maybe a man walking in a room.
Let's get started. White nationalism. It's alive in the United States, but not everyone agrees.
White nationalism and its proliferation online have real consequences.
There isn't a single adult today that in good conscience would make the argument that America is a more white nationalist society than it was when my grandfather was growing up.
Hate crimes increase for the third consecutive year, FBI reports.
White supremacy, racism, white nationalism, words that once held real meaning, have now become nothing more than election strategies.
Americans have died because of it.
As language changes, it's important for us to be able to understand dog whistles.
The myth of things. Like the Southern Switch and the Southern Strategy, which never happened.
Counties that hosted a 2016 Trump rally saw a 226% increase in hate crimes.
If they actually were concerned about white nationalism, they would be holding hearings on Antifa.
I did not call this hearing so that some may promote the very messages we need to combat.
The House Judiciary Committee held a hearing on Tuesday that was supposed to tackle the rise of hate crimes and the spreading of white supremacy and hate speech on platforms like Facebook and YouTube. It was the Democrats' chance to shine a light on a very real problem. According to the FBI, reported hate crimes surged nearly 20% in 2017. And because police departments don't have to send this data to the federal government, the Human Rights Campaign says that that number is likely an undercount. But after more than 4 hours of questioning and testimony, no solutions emerged. Instead, it became clear just how partisan the very issue of hate has become. And we turn now to two people who can help us parse through some of what was said and what solutions could be on the horizon. Heidi Beirich is the director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project, and Andy Campbell is a senior reporter at HuffPost covering extremism. Welcome to you both.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Heidi, let's start with you. This hearing, I mean, I know people are saying this is happening in 2019. Yes, it's 2019. Why are we discussing this now, Heidi? Remind us.
Well, sadly, even though it's 2019, we are now at a point where white nationalism has sort of spread like wildfire through the web and frankly across the Western world. And it's a movement that is growing, both if you count the number of hate groups, if you look at the kind of material you find online. And of course, it's creating mass violence like the horror that we saw in Christchurch, New Zealand a few weeks ago. So it's a pretty serious topic.
This was supposed to be Congress sitting across the table from a panel of experts on hate and white nationalism, which is super exciting because finally, this is a fountain of knowledge for Congress to draw from. You also had two executives from Facebook and Google sitting there, platforms where white supremacy has run rampant. And so we have all of these people in the same room ready to take questions and talk to each other about this huge problem. Then they introduce far-right conservative Candace Owens, who Republicans invited. Candace Owens became famous for her appearances on InfoWars, which is a conspiracy theory show by conspiracy theorist Alex Jones. She kind of skyrocketed after Trump tweeted her last year. She was at CPAC earlier this year, and she's a regular on Fox News. But she's also consistently the loudest person in the room, and I think that's a good guess as to why she was invited here, because she completely derailed the entire day.
She's also a Black American who the GOP brought to talk about something very specific here. Tell us a little bit about how that went down.
She says that she was the victim of a hate crime herself, but really what the conversation turned to was she immediately said that white supremacy wasn't a big deal. She said that hate crimes were not on the rise, that that was fake, She immediately, with her opening statement, said that this entire meeting was a farce.
White supremacy, racism, white nationalism, words that once held real meaning, have now become nothing more than election strategies. Every 4 years, the Black community is offered handouts and fear. Handouts and fear.
I want to lay out a couple of things here. Charlottesville, Pittsburgh, Black Lives Matter. I mean, we can go on and on with real data and real incidences that show that white supremacy and nationalism are on the rise. Heidi, your response to what Owens's comments were?
Well, I mean, her comments are not just wrong, they're outrageous, and they're an attempt to act as though a very, very serious problem doesn't exist. I mean, it's really unfortunate that Republicans would bring someone like her to talk about, you know, an ideology, a way of thinking that has led to several mass shooting incidents. And I might add that Candace Owens was also listed as an inspiration in the manifesto of the New Zealand shooter. So that makes it even more of a mockery. I mean, look, she's just flat out wrong, and she's trying to minimize something that's really serious and needs to be dealt with in a serious manner.
Andy, there was also someone else there, Muhammad Abu Salah, and his children were killed in a hate crime. Tell us about Dr. Abu Salah. Who brought him and what's his story?
Well, the Democrats, I believe, invited him, but his two daughters and son-in-law were killed in a racist shooting at UNC Chapel Hill.
February 10, 2015, that was the day our lives changed forever when my two daughters, Yusuf and Razan, and my son-in-law, Dia, were shot to death execution style. When we arrived at the scene, yellow tape and flashing lights froze the blood in our veins. We had waited almost 6 hours before police officers confirmed that Dia, Yusuf, and Razan had all been shot to death. But we never heard in the media that the murderer hated them. Trouble began when this man observed my two daughters appearing on the scene, adorned with their hijabs. This condescending man told her he hated how she looked and dressed.
And he has been an activist ever since. And so these are the types of stories that we wanted to hear and what we wanted Congress to hear. So to have Candace Owens sitting at the same table as him saying that what he experienced isn't real, it was devastating. And then, you know, Republican Congressman, Representative Ken Buck of Colorado joked with Candace at one point saying that she triggers the libs and said, you should come shoot guns in Colorado with me sometime. To have that exchange happen when Mr. Salah was sitting a few chairs away, I mean, it's insensitive and it's wrong.
There were also lots of comments during the testimony, during the hearing in YouTube, that was live streaming the hearing, Heidi. Tell us a little bit about YouTube's response and what they felt that they had to do and the nature of those comments.
Yeah, well, the YouTube live stream of the hearing was just filled with racist, anti-Semitic, sort of the ugliest sentiments you can imagine. And YouTube eventually had to cut that off because it was so out of control. And if anything demonstrates how serious this problem is in the United States and around the world, it was the fact that that kind of vitriol could be thrown so quickly at YouTube. And frankly, it also shows the role the technology plays in spreading these beliefs. I mean, this is the main way that white supremacists get their ideas out there. They don't have any other platforms other than the web to say what they have to say. And it's unfortunate that that dimension was also mocked by at least one of the Republican congressmen there.
Heidi, I want to pick up on what you just said about technology. Alexandria Walden, who's Google's public policy counsel, responded yesterday to a question about how Google is addressing white nationalism. Let's take a listen.
Internally, we have an intel desk that looks to see and track trends of what we're seeing on our platform, but also we engage with external experts so that we can understand what others are seeing.
Heidi, is that enough?
It's not enough. I mean, frankly, the mainstream platforms like YouTube, like Facebook, Twitter, did not really wake up to this problem or take it seriously enough until after the horrible events in Charlottesville in August of 2017. And so they're really behind the eight ball in terms of getting this kind of material off of their sites. I'm assuming that they will get better at this in the future, but it's been kind of a mess for the last couple of years.
Andy, I want to go a little further here because there's a lot of attention on Google and Facebook and YouTube and whether these companies are doing enough to prevent these messages from being spread. Did the issue of where this is even coming from come up at all in this hearing? In other words, you know, we're talking about preventing it, but that feels like a game of whack-a-mole, to be honest with you. What about the root causes in this country that are leading to this increase in white nationalism? Was that even addressed in this hearing?
I would say that they didn't have much more time with the, you know, Facebook and Google exec to do anything more than let them read off of a press release. However, Facebook has shown the inability to find and deal with the root cause here. After the New Zealand shooting, Facebook came out with new expanded rules saying extremism, white nationalism, white supremacy are not allowed on our platform anymore. They're just done. A week later, after they came out with these rules, I gave them an easy test, a softball, saying here is a prominent white nationalist whose name is Faith Goldie. She's one of the most prominent white nationalists in North America. She has videos on here saying that Jews and black people are invaders who should pay white Europeans to live in their countries. They responded by saying, despite their new rules, that this wasn't white nationalist at all and is fine on our platform. There was outcry, and they finally deleted Faith Goldie's Facebook. One of the representatives at this hearing read some of that story and offered it to the Facebook exec, who just responded and said, you know, this is a game of whack-a-mole. We'll take him down when we see him. It's obvious that they don't have the ability to find things before we out them as the media.
Heidi, what about the root causes here? I'd love to hear your thoughts on this also. There's one thing to control the messages that are coming out, but what does this tell us about the state of the United States today in terms of, I mean, we've never had an easy history when it comes to race. We've even struggled to call things racist when they clearly are. But this rise in white nationalism, I think, is pointing to a deeper issue in our society.
Yeah, well, there is a segment of the American society, and this is rooted in our history, that is not very happy with the changing demographics that we're facing. You could actually say this about the entire Western world, where immigration is changing the demographic makeup of countries. And they're reacting in a very ugly way to those changes. And that's one of the things that's been driving the number of hate groups up. But there are other factors that fuel that negative behavior. The amount of sort of sewage online, the recruiting that goes on there into hate groups, and frankly, the actions of prominent political figures who play to those fears. Donald Trump has played to anti-immigrant sentiment, anti-Muslim sentiment, and that's true of other politicians in the United States and far-right populists abroad. And those people, when they do that, they sanction those beliefs, which makes people feel more comfortable sort of, you know, putting out extremist ideas, being racist, being anti-Semitic. So we have a dynamic where the online world is fueling this, changing demographics are making some people insecure, and politicians of the highest levels are also sanctioning those kinds of thoughts and ideas. And this is all turned into a very combustible mix that results in things like what happened at the Pittsburgh synagogue or at the mosques in Christchurch.
Heidi Beirich of the Southern Poverty Law Center and Andy Campbell of HuffPost have been with us. Thanks to you both.
So good to be here.
Thank you.
All right, everybody, we're heading down to Georgia for this next one. Six Republican lawmakers in Georgia are sponsoring a bill to create a state ethics board to oversee journalists. Under the bill, journalists would have to turn over interview tapes and notes at the board's request. And if they refuse, journalists would face fines of $100 a day and possible lawsuits. Representative Andrew Welch, who introduced the bill, said he had a problem with certain kinds of media coverage.
News stories, which tell only part of the story and which cloak opinions and erroneous conclusions as factual, even if constructed on false premises.
Georgia Speaker of the House David Ralston put it a little differently.
It is very difficult to discern for the public as to what is an editorial commentary on something and what is the facts that the article is based on. Blending the two seems to be what has become more prevalent in the media than a separate analysis of facts versus commentary.
Journalists and press associations across the state and the country have balked at the proposal, saying it would violate the First Amendment and hamper the press's ability to scrutinize Georgia's elected officials. Stephen Fowler is a political reporter for Georgia Public Broadcasting, and he joins us now. And he wrote about the bill for the Columbia Journalism Review. Stephen, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Before we even begin, I mean, you and I are both journalists. This sent a chill down my spine. I think a lot of our listeners may not quite understand why this is so concerning. As journalists, can you help us understand?
Well, when the bill was first read on the House floor, those of us in the House press gallery kind of laughed at it when we heard it in passing because it was the last day of the session and it was busy. But then we got our hands on the text of the bill, and that's when the concern kind of happened. What this bill does is regulating how we as journalists do our job in a way that is not previously done before and is not something that is allowed under the Constitution, under the First Amendment. And it would put a lot of restrictions and restraints on the freedom of the press and on the potential for the press to report on things or to be able to report on things freely and independently. And that's what a lot of the concerns I've heard from my colleagues here in Georgia.
Now, what prompted this legislation? Was this legislators who were piqued about coverage about something?
Well, the Republican lawmaker who filed this isn't talking much now. He actually said he was resigning from his seat after the end of this session, but we think it has something to do with a TV reporter asking him a question about another bill that he filed. But we're really unclear about what specifically led to this bill being dropped. The bill sponsor did say that it also maybe had something to do with some national news media instead of local.
What are the chances of this bill moving forward? I mean, how much support does it have? Because if that's the case, it sounds like this is a personal dispute with the media. As we know, that's not a new thing, at least for the past couple of years. But does this have broader institutional support?
Well, Republican Andy Welch from McDonough, the bill's sponsor, put it on the last day of the session, so it can't be discussed until the next session begins in January. And he also said he's resigning from his seat. We've seen reaction from all parts of the ideological spectrum here in Georgia. Journalists, non-journalists, politicians say this bill does not seem a good idea. It doesn't seem like it would jive with the First Amendment. So the chances of this actually moving, I would say, are slim to none. But it's the message that it sends that may resonate a little bit longer.
Stephen, we know my former employer, CNN, has their headquarters in Atlanta. Did you get a sense that this might be aimed at them? We sort of talked about the national media outlets that might be the target of this.
Well, you know, Representative Welch, in an interview with reporters after he filed the bill later in the hallway, said that part of this was a desire to kind of call out the national media outlets. He mentioned newspapers and cable TV shows and other things that he says don't clearly label what is fact-based reporting versus what's an opinion on an issue, and they kind of blur the lines between the two. So CNN being headquartered in Atlanta, perhaps he's talking about CNN or other cable outlets, but there is this level of the national media being conflated with what we do at the local state house or at the state level or regional papers and radio and things like that, that I think these lawmakers and members of the public tend to conflate what they see with the New York Times and what they see with CNN that they may or may not like with what the, you know, local state government reporter does covering things in and out for the local community.
And, you know, one of the things that comes up often when we talk about the media is exactly what you said, sort of parsing that apart and making sure that there's more media literacy. We spoke to Janice Hume, as a journalism professor who teaches a class called Credibility, the News Media, and Public Trust. And she told us that in order to win back some of this trust that apparently the public has lost in the media, that we journalists need to do a better job of showing our work. Let's take a listen to what she had to say.
I would like to see sidebars in the digital products or in the print products where we explain why did we use an anonymous source? Why did we make this particular choice in terms of a visual to use with this story? I think it could be done with the articles. And I also think we could do a better job of just going out there and talking to the public and explaining to them why we do what we do and why what we do is critically important.
Stephen, we're both reporters. I understand the need to clearly show our listeners or our audiences what's opinion versus what's not, right? And I think a lot of us already do that. But this idea of explaining to that extent, to the extent that Professor Hume is talking about, what's your thought on that?
I am wholeheartedly a fan of showing your work as a journalist, of media literacy, of media ethics, and explaining these things, because I think it's almost as important as the actual story being told. For this Columbia Journalism Review piece, there's no sidebar saying how I got this story, but you can see in an interview with this person, in an interview with this reporter, in an interview with this, so it's not making up quotes out of thin air and things like that. There are certain newspapers around the country that are putting these sidebars of how we got this story, how we decided to report this story. And I think one of the things that I like doing is engaging with people on social media and kind of showing my work of how I report on things or where I got things from or what I'm doing on social media so that people can see the pictures and the video and the conversations that I'm having. And if there's a voice that I'm missing, you know, somebody will say, you haven't talked to this person. And I think, you know, opening up the doors of journalism will only help what we do and help the public's understanding of what we do of, you know, maybe not sharing the entire thought process of giving everyone an open Google Doc of your script, but, you know, showing the work of what we do, I think, is so important because it builds that trust and it shows that we're not making things up and that these are real people doing jobs, talking to real people about these issues.
And it also should be noted that we can't make things up. Like you said, we have codes of ethics and legal and constitutional duties here as journalists, so we have to make sure that we abide by those. Stephen Fowler is a political reporter for Georgia Public Broadcasting. Stephen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Hey everyone, it's Tanzina Vega, and we're back with The Takeaway. The NHL playoffs start this week, and if you're not watching hockey, well, this is a pretty good time to jump in on the action. Here in New York, the Islanders are facing off against the Pittsburgh Penguins in a first-round matchup that didn't seem likely at the beginning of the season.
I think the Islanders, I don't think a lot of people pegged them as a team that would make the playoffs, let alone one that would make a run at the top spot in the division. So the fact that the Islanders are in the playoffs, if you told people that in October, they would have been surprised, but the fans really are expecting a lot from them and looking forward to them having a really good first round against the Pittsburgh Penguins.
That's Shannon Hogan, the broadcast host for the Islanders on the MSG Network.
Well, right now he's playing like an all-star, and speaking of the all-star game, which is coming up in a couple of days, Matt Barzal going as the representative for the New York Islanders, his first time with an all-star experience. It was interesting because
while the team on the ice are turning heads for their unexpected winning record this year, they've also attracted notice for their efforts to include more women in broadcast roles that have traditionally been held down by men. This season, Shannon was joined in the broadcast booth by two former pro hockey players, AJ Malesko and Jennifer Botterill. I spoke with Shannon about what it was like being paired with a team of all women analysts and also just some hockey talk. She's a busy woman, so we got her on FaceTime.
It feels great. I mean, when the conversation came up that we might have one female analyst, let alone two, I was thrilled. I also was very familiar with what Jennifer and AJ would be able to bring. AJ Malesko was part of the first U.S. women's team to compete in the Olympics in Nagano. They won the gold medal. And then Jennifer Botterill and AJ were teammates at Harvard. They won the NCAA tournament. And Jennifer went on to compete for Team Canada for many, many years and has three gold medals for Team Canada as well. So these aren't just women who know the sport. They've played the sport and they're great personalities. And for me as a woman, you don't see a ton of female analysts.
Yeah, what's interesting is that there are times when I've been, you know, as a journalist myself, I've been on panels talking about issues that have nothing to do with women, for example, things like, you know, politics or what have you. And you notice when you're at a table with all other women journalists, it's still sort of a surprise. What's the reception been like for you all from the fans and viewers?
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that about being on a panel. I will never forget my first season covering the Islanders. They have like the broadcast meetings here. They usually meet either in New York or Toronto. And that year they happened to meet in New York. And it's not just the hosts and analysts, but it's also people behind the scenes. And they had a reception after. And I remember walking in this very fancy restaurant in New York City and looking around and realizing there were probably 150 to 200 people there. And there were four women. And I just remember thinking, wow, I mean, I knew that we were kind of a rarity, but I wasn't thinking it was this many. And there are more reporters and hosts around the league. But for the analyst role, that is something that has been new. And I think just being a part of that has been exciting. And I think the basic thing with the Islanders fans is they're smart, passionate fans. And if you know your hockey, they want to hear from you. I mean, it's been a wonderful, exciting season for them as well. And they feel very welcomed by the Islanders fans.
And we know the tide is certainly changing, at least when it comes to having more representation of, like you said, women in traditionally male-dominated spaces, people of color in traditionally white spaces, and on and on. But there are still some issues, I think, in being some of the first. Are there challenges that you still have to deal with in working and operating in such a traditionally male industry and male sport?
Well, for most of my professional career, I've been in sports, and it's not just hockey. I've covered baseball, basketball. But within the league, now that I've personally been around for several years, I feel like that respect is earned and then given. And the players especially that I've had the pleasure of dealing with have always treated me with respect. You know, you'll see on social media, you know, why is she talking about this? Or why do we have three women? You do see a little bit of that. But I think the vast majority just want great content. The other important thing, Tanzina, is that women have to help other women. I mean, we have to be each other's champion. Just because there's one woman on a broadcast doesn't mean there can't be another. And I think sometimes when you look around at the sports space, you'll see a panel or you'll see, you know, a team's coverage, and they might just have one female host. And what I love that MSG has done is I don't have to be the token female. You know, we have two other smart women that know what they're talking about, and the three of us put together a strong show.
The one and done scenario, which often plays out when you're the only one or one of few, and it's like, okay, well, we have a woman, check. You know, we have a person of color, check. And then I think what happens is that you end up losing the emphasis on your expertise, right? The reason why you're there is because you're a hockey expert, right? Not just because we're lady journos, right? So I think that that's a really important point about supporting women and supporting each other in this space. What kind of opportunities are you seeing opening up for women in professional sports, whether it be behind the scenes or in front of the camera like you are?
There are more and more roles for quote-unquote sideline or ringside reporters. Maybe 10 years ago, if you tuned in and you watched a broadcast, you were like, all right, well, maybe I can be the person that just asks questions during intermission, or maybe I could be a sideline reporter. And I think over the last 10 to 15 years, you've seen more and more women in a quote-unquote studio role or in a hosting role. And the analyst role, which Jennifer and AJ have stepped into for us, I think other networks are taking notice that it's been successful. And I think we're going to continue to see that, as the NHL has a great initiative right now for gender equality and a push for if you can play, you can play, and encouraging young women to play the sport. And it's interesting hearing from AJ and Jennifer, their experience growing up playing hockey is very different than what their daughters are going to experience. We've even just this year, the number of parents that have come up and said, my daughter loves you guys. It's so important that they see women and they know that one day if they wanted that job, that could be theirs.
And I'm also, I mean, you're also about to become a mom. So congratulations to you
that.
In this career, you're on the road a lot. You're sort of dealing with, you know, just the demands of a production schedule. How are you feeling? And are you feeling supported by the league during this process?
I've been very supported from the get-go by MSG Networks. I think as a woman in any professional capacity, there's always this, like you said, what if? What if, you know, they're not going to really be excited about it. Everybody was so excited. My, you know, the crew that I get to work with day in and day out on all of our games have been so helpful. I have been also very fortunate that I have other working moms, women that are working in sports around the league and in other leagues that are trying to do the balance. And they've been very candid about it. And I think for me, hearing what they're doing and their emotions has been helpful, that I'm not going in blindfolded thinking that I'm not going to have hard days. I know that I will. And I know that if I'm away from the baby traveling, it will be hard sometimes. But I also think there are some great benefits to being a working mom and showing your son or daughter that you can add that part to your life. And that's a part of who you are as well.
We wish you all the best. Shannon Hogan, broadcast host for the New York Islanders on the MSG Network. Shannon, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And you can watch Shannon and the rest of the New York Islanders coverage for Game 1 against the Pittsburgh Penguins tonight on the MSG Network. And I just got this note from my control room. Go Islanders! And that's our show for today. We appreciate you listening. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and we'll see you tomorrow.